pushing through, the snowdrops want to rise. Still I look to see you in these frosty night skies. First light of spring, my love, first light of spring. First light of spring, my love, is sweeter than anything.
Hello and welcome to Gardener's Corner. And today, as early April arrives, we're celebrating spring with the undisputed flower of the moment, the daffodil. Whether you love daffodils to be pale, dainty and diminutive, or you like the vivid many-petaled doubles, or perhaps you prefer them to be understated, traditional and golden, you'll find them all bobbing and dancing in the breeze at Ringhaddy on the shores of Strangford Loch, where we went to meet daffodil breeder and grower Neil Watson. Neil, I have to say it's wonderful when you ask the question. It's a question we probably ask quite frequently of passionate gardeners. Have you a favourite plant or have you a favourite flower? And how fantastic that whenever I asked you that question 2 minutes ago, you said, I absolutely do. And here it is on the kitchen table in front of us. It's just spangly and bright. It's tiny and compact, and it's just an exquisite new daffodil.
It is new. It's released last year. We call it Little Alice, and the reason we call it Little Alice is because my little daughter Alice picked it out of the seedling bed several years ago. She's not so little anymore, but that's why we call it Little Alice, and it's very popular.
But it's packed with colour and densely petalled as well. Maybe, if you would, you would describe it for us.
Well, it's a small double that's known as an intermediate, which means it's not actually miniature, but it's a lot smaller than the big standards. It's got a nice yellow perianth, and the petaloids in the middle are a sort of glowing orange, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
I'm sure it really sings out in the garden.
It does. You can spot it a mile off. And on the show bench, you can spot it a mile off as well.
Do you find, Neil, that people are looking for daffodils for different kinds of situations and different shapes and sizes of gardens?
They are. I think people's gardens are getting smaller and smaller now, and because of that, people are generally looking for smaller daffodils. Some of the larger daffodils now, they're pretty big plants as well as being big flowers. And I was talking to a girl the other day in Edinburgh, and she said she just had a window box so couldn't have daffodils. So I said, no, that's not true. You can have daffodils because we have daffodils with flowers ranging from the size of my thumbnail up to 5 inches across. So, yes, you can have a daffodil in any situation.
You can grow successionally, can't you? You can have daffodils from when until when?
Our first ones to flower in probably the end of October, and then the last ones would finish middle to end of May, depending on the season. So, yes, we have them most of the year round. And in fact, there are now autumn flowering daffodils. They do occur naturally in autumn ones. And as breeders, we're now trying to develop them because the natural flowering ones are quite hard to get to flower, so the amateur probably couldn't do it. So we're now trying to develop an autumn flowering daffodil so that people can have daffodils more often.
There aren't too many species that will give you flowers for as long a period of time as that, are there?
I would think not. I've been told on good authority that somewhere in the world there's a daffodil flowering every month except August.
So where are you taking us to, Neil, first?
We're just coming up, actually it's on the way to the daffodil field, but it's up these nice stone steps, and we've got this central bed here, and I just really wanted to show you these two double primulas. Apparently the Victorian, and somebody gave them to my mother and said, whatever you do, don't lose those because they're very rare. So I tried to look after them. To my horror, last year the sheep got out, and they were eaten down to the, basically down to the roots, but they seem to have liked it. They've flowered dramatically this year.
So bit of tough love.
Bit of tough love, yeah.
They're really pretty. They're nearly like a little wood anemone. They're doubles and very kind of creamy white. But they love it under the trees here, and you've hellebores and you've little grape hyacinths and you've wild native primroses as well, I see. Perfect situation for them.
So the wild ones are seeded themselves there, but I like them so much I leave them there. Yeah, the hostas are slowly coming. That's Orientalis hellebores, obviously seeded all over the place. I don't want to pull them up because I'm hoping that some of them are doubles.
Absolutely. And I see you go for the removing the foliage take on hellebores, do you?
Yeah. I like the winter because everything's so tidy. When things start to grow, it gets less tidy. So I just take away all the dead leaves, really, just when I see the new foliage coming up. I just cut off all the dead ones. And
it's kind of hard not to, isn't it?
It
whenever
is,
the leaves look a wee bit blackened and frosts can do their stuff at this time of year too. So you obviously get a wee bit of time to do some gardening.
The garden generally is has to look after itself, and as you can probably see, it's a fairly wild sort of garden. But we do put some time in, particularly in the winter. So we try to tidy it up, and we try to have everything in such a way that we don't actually have to do a lot of work apart from cut the grass.
You're right on the shoreline. You couldn't be closer to Strangford Loch if you tried, Ringhaddy here. Do you find the plants that you grow on, more particularly obviously the daffodils, are suited to being this close to the coast?
I think so. People say that our daffodils are particularly good and we have very good colours. And one of the reasons put forward for that was that we get double light, the reflection of the water onto the daffodils. So whether that affects the garden as well, I couldn't say.
And you've got quite a lot of old trees here which are going to break the force of the wind a little, aren't they?
They certainly help, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sure you were grateful for them when you came to live here.
Very grateful.
Oh my goodness, Neil. So we've just come out from under the tree canopy into this wonderful County Down, Drumlin-like hilly field. And here's the light that you were talking about a minute or two ago. This wonderful light bathing. It's like a patchwork quilt of blocks of daffodils. Soft, buttery, creamy yellows to bright golds, of course. How do you ever keep a track of where what everything is and where everything is?
We have to be pretty strict on that because traceability is all the word nowadays, and the department want to know where everything is. So you can see the sort of rows, serried rows of white labels, and they're all marked on a chart, so we know exactly where everything is.
For anybody who doesn't know, the whole business of creating a new daffodil is a job for a patient man or woman, isn't it? It takes a very long time, and you don't even know what you're going to get at the end of it.
No, you're quite right. It's a patience is the essence. From when you pollinate the daffodil, it takes, if you're lucky, you'll get a flower in 4 years, generally 5 years, 6 years, and then it'd be another maybe 10 years before you have enough to be commercial. So it's a slow job. Also, my mentor said, expect one good flower in 1,000 seeds.
You're talking of mentors, and we have to say at this point, Northern Ireland has an absolutely exceptional reputation for breeding daffodils. For those who don't know, it stretches back quite some time too.
It does. Ireland generally, I think our climate's very good, and not just daffodils. I mean, we're breeders of many plants, but daffodils in particular, certainly from the turn of the century, Lissadell was well known at the turn of the century, and then we've well-known breeders such as Guy Wilson and Tom Bloomer and the more modern ones, Frank Harrison, Kate Reid, Brian Duncan, and I like to think in the future myself.
What have you been particularly excited with this year? Well, I shouldn't say this year, but this 7 years, what have you been waiting for and delighted to see?
Well, I have two or three different things coming up of my own breeding, that we've several interesting ones of other people's breedings, because we take in our catalogue has flowers from amateur breeders as well as mine and Brian Duncan's. But I've got a couple of very nice doubles coming on. I have one particularly deep-coloured double, which seems to be getting the Americans very excited, although I haven't shown it in Britain yet, so I don't know how the British are going to respond.
This is a very busy time of year for you, of course, showing and travelling the world to let people see the fruits of your labour.
It is. I was in Mississippi 10 days ago, and I was in Edinburgh last weekend, and I'll be off to London in a couple of weeks. So, yes.
So the worldwide passion for daffodils is not diminished in any way, is it?
Not at all. I think at the moment, the States are a major breeders and growers of daffodils. Tasmania and New Zealand would be the main ones. Japan, we have a lot of customers in Japan. Even Russia, we have a customer in Moscow. What is like growing daffodils there? I'm not quite sure.
Oh, you'll have to go and see.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll have to go and see, get a little bit more up close and personal with these gorgeous daffodils, because at the moment they're a little way off.
I mean, if you look at these big ones now, they've pretty much reached perfection. And so now we're concentrating much more on health, expanding the season and shrinking the size. So that's basically our main aims at the moment.
Those are so beautiful. A lovely kind of long trumpet. Are those sepals? They're petals.
It's the perianth and the corona, the sort of technical terms for them. We'll try feeling one, because you'll see that the substance, as we call it, of a daffodil now is so much better than the old King Alfred. They're much more solid. They stand up to the weather better.
Indeed they are. Very vigorous, especially the trumpet.
You can bash them around fairly well. And it's my old mentor used to say, you pick it up and you shake it, and if the neck comes off, it's no good. You know, we're breeding for strong plants now.
Yes, absolutely. And what wonderfully vivid colour. I mean, these are a traditional bright golden yellow daffodil.
They're very much the traditional type, yes. We have some more elaborate ones there.
Just beside, yes, absolutely. Like a peach and ivory. Much more frilly, much shorter trumpet.
Those are known as split coronas, as you can see the cup is all split. They're also known as orchid flowered or papillon daffodils.
You mentioned health, Neil. What are the kind of main kind of threats to gorgeous daffodils in the ordinary garden?
Eelworm is the thing we really dread, and that's why I ask you to put things on your feet, because I just don't want to get eelworm in here. Other things, we have the narcissus fly, which is often responsible for the masses of little tiny leaves coming up and no flowers, because it eats out the middle of the bulb and you just leaves come up and no flowers. Little narcissus fly and fungus. You probably see that they've been sprayed with a fungicide. But I mean, that's the fungicide. I wouldn't recommend gardeners to do it, because we do it because A, we need them for show, and B, is to make sure we have absolutely perfectly healthy plants, at least for export.
You've shown us this absolutely iridescent golden yellow daffodil, and beside it the kind of peachy ivory double. What of the tinier ones you were talking about earlier? What are you particularly pleased with this year?
Well, if you look over at these ones just starting to flower over here, these are what we cycliminous daffodils. The cycliminous is a species, and they're quite small, and they have that very swept back perianth. The petals are swept back, and on the species they go right back to touching the stalk. As you can probably see in those hybrids, you can see that swept back flared look. Looks as if they're a girl standing in the wind with her hair blowing back. The next variety is a pink one of the same type, but it's very short and a small flower.
I think they're like little seahorses.
Little seahorse, absolutely, yes, that's a good description. We have, I would think, probably now about between 500 and 600 varieties. So there's an enormous variation, and people say, well, how can you tell the difference between them? But if you do look closely, you can see that there is a difference.
Do you grow the tiny little hoop petticoat, the wee bulbicodium? They're so delicate.
I do, but they're just in the garden. They're not even flowering yet. But we are breeding, working on the little tiny short ones. As I say, we have some which are probably only about less than 10 centimetres high and probably about 1.5 centimetres across the flower. So very, very small.
We'll take a wander around your garden, if we may, a little bit later on, mm-hmm. and you can talk to us about what exactly you're growing in the garden.
Right.
But before we leave the beds, it's hard to know kind of what to pick out, because they're all so beautiful. How does it work from a point of view of somebody wanting to increase the daffodils in their own garden and buy Irish daffodils, Irish bred daffodils? How does that work? When's your busiest time of year? Is it now when everything's in bloom, do you find, or is it in the kind of end of summer, autumn, when people are planning their garden?
Well, we personally, this time of year, we're showing the public what we have. We take the flowers around the world and it shows them what's available. Our next busy time would probably be end of June, beginning of July, when we dig all the bulbs. And then the next busiest time would be September, when we send out all the parcels. And then October we plant. And then we have a little bit of rest where we get websites and catalogues sorted out.
Fairly busy year,
then. It's a busy year, yeah.
So all these bulbs you will dig up?
We work in a two-year cycle. So the ones we're looking at the moment have been down for 2 years. And they will be dug this year, yeah. And basically what we do is, after they're dug, they're sorted out into saleable size ones. Ones we were going to replant, and we sell off all the saleable ones and we just replant. We've got, the secret is to keep our stock manageable. Everything's done by hand. We use a machine for ploughing and rotivating, and that's about it. So we have to keep our stocks fairly small. If you want vast quantities, the Dutch would buy from us, and then it becomes available in the garden centres.
Do you have to feed the field after all that industry?
I feed once a year. I feed potato fertilizer when I see the shoots just appearing above the ground, and that's all. And I literally do it very biblical. I walk down the bed with a bucket in one hand and I just scatter the fertilizer. So that's all.
Really. Must be a good feeling.
Oh, great feeling, particularly when you see them coming up.
Across the earth I see you, swan-like moving there. The sun comes over trees and throws its light upon your head. I'm shaken by a blackbird, I turn to hear its song. Looking back, I cannot see you, my one and only one. First light of spring, my love, first light of spring. First light of spring, my love, sweeter than anything.
We're just on our way to the shore, Neil, and round to the front garden, if you like, although I get the feeling your garden wraps itself right around the house. Beautiful. But we passed a little clump of cycloninium there, and tucked behind the grape hyacinths, a little bulbocodium, just foliage to see at the moment. And we're just in front of another lovely little clump of another tiny daffodil. It looks fantastic beside the bamboo. And this just kind of makes the point that we were making in the kitchen earlier, that there are daffodils for so many different sorts of situations.
Absolutely. The one we're looking at the moment is growing out of builder's rubble. And it's called Narcissus canaliculatus, if you can get your tongue around that. I used to grow it in the field, and you see this particular clump actually has got a lot of grassiness around it. I used to grow it in the field, and I just got grass, like a field of wheat. And I mentioned that to my mentor, Frank Harrison, and he said, oh, you're looking after it too well. Treat it badly, then it'll flower. So put it somewhere with no soil and let it get baked, and that's just what it does. And you see that one's going to have massive flowers on it.
Absolutely. But isn't that good to know that there are daffodils that can take that kind of tough love and that like to be baked hard and can grow in gravel?
Well, the Tazetta types particularly, that's the, what do they call it, paperwhite you get at Christmas. It likes to be baked in the summer.
They are so exquisite, aren't they?
They are. The one that flowers very early with us, the one that flowers in October, it's so strongly scented that every year I make the mistake of bringing a bunch in, but it lasts about an hour.
It's a
lovely scent, but it would give you a headache after a while. It's just so powerful. Should we just go along the front of the house?
You lead on and just talk us through what you've got here, if you would.
Inevitably, there are daffodils. This is a particularly nice orange one, and I've used it as a parent. It's called Craig Dew, Scottish. And the deep colour I've been using to try and get into some of the more different types.
Beautiful shape. Flower.
It's a nice shape.
Beautiful shape.
The only thing wrong with it, it has quite a long neck, which makes it not very strong in the garden.
You have it planted beside a lovely soft kind of purpley pink primrose, and beside the hyacinths.
Hyacinths are ones that were, over the years, have been in bowls over Christmas, and when they finish flowering, they've just been healed into the garden. And they seem to be quite happy. Those have been there probably 5 or 6 years now.
I love that shade of blue.
It's a lovely blue, isn't it?
Very vivid, as vivid as the orange and the yellow of the daffodil. So what else have you here, Neil?
Agapanthus, which I think has survived. It looks as if it has.
Yes, it does.
It loves it here, and it's seeded all over the place. The seeds have probably died down, the seedlings.
You've done it a favour, I would say, by leaving on the old foliage until the frosts are well and truly gone.
I do that every year, just to make sure that it is all right.
And more wild primroses.
There are a few daffodils in here. This bed is interesting because it just gives you an idea of what to do with daffodils. Now, everyone gets upset about the leaves, and nobody really likes the dead leaves, but they're very important to have because they're what feed the bulb for all your flowers next year. Now, here we've grown the different clumps of daffodils, but you can see coming up between them are the peonies. Now, the reason for this is that as the leaves die down, the peonies are coming up in front of them and hide the dead leaves. Then, as I said earlier, the less work, the better. So I don't really do anything with that. And when they're well and truly died down, just rake them off and have done with it.
And if you deadhead the daffodils as you're going out, that's going to be quite a job for you here with the quantities that you have. But it does help immediately to tidy things, doesn't it?
It does. The one thing don't do, and I stress don't to everyone, don't waste your time tying them up with little elastic bands and little bunches, because it's the worst thing you can do, and it's an awful lot of hard work.
And it's so good to hear that again, because it is something that you know, still people ask about and wonder about. So just leave the leaves alone.
Absolutely. And why give yourself work, particularly when you're doing damage to the bulb?
Neil, when we're talking practicalities, what are your rules of thumb for actually planting the bulbs?
I suppose the greatest rule of thumb would plant too deep rather than too shallow. About 2.5 times the depth of the bulb of soil on top of it is sort of just general rule of thumb. I plant, as you saw in the field, I plant them in rows. They're probably about an inch and a half between the bulbs. And I would probably go a bit wider than that in the garden. If you've got particularly nice bulbs, I would recommend you dig them every third year probably and divide them up and plant them. A little bit of bone meal under the bulbs when you plant them. You know, take care if you've got cats and dogs, because they love bone meal and they'll dig up your bulbs, as will foxes. So planting that would be about it. Bit of feed as the bulbs come up, as the shoots come up.
If you're dividing, lifting and dividing, do you replant now, or do you take the bulbs away, store them and plant them in the autumn?
I better be careful what I say. You can replant in the green, as you do with snowdrops, but I would recommend that you dig them late June. Really, 5-6 weeks after the last flowers are gone, you can cut the tops off and you can dig them. Probably better in a garden is to wait till the leaves have died back. Dig them up, let them dry. I actually let them have a bit of a roost in the sun. Careful they don't get sunburned, but let them crisp up in the sun. Store them in a dry, cool, airy place until the soil temperature starts to drop, which is usually late October.
And it also saves you digging them up inadvertently, you know, if you're planting herbaceous material or you're kind of reinvigorating the garden during the summer, I suppose.
Absolutely. And it gives you some idea. Inevitably, you're going to leave some behind and they're going to come up in the following year. But it gives you a bit of idea of what you've got and how it is. Say you miss 3 years and they've gone on for 10, 15 years, you'll tend to get big, huge clumps and they've sucked all the nutrients out from underneath them. And if you dug those, you'll find you've got little tiny bulbs. If you want to replant them, I would recommend that you either just do replant them with a good space between them, or if you can, line them out in a vegetable garden, let them grow on for a couple of years to get nice big bulbs, and then plant them out again. Not everybody has the luxury of having the space to do that, but if you can, do that. On the other hand, just if they're supermarket-type bulbs, just dig them up and, dare I say it, throw them away and start again.
These look great now, Neil. You have them in a semicircular raised stone bed, lovely local stone, and obviously the drainage is very good. And again, do you feed these the same as you would feed the bulbs in the field?
If I remember. Probably every second year. And the clumps are getting a bit big, and I probably at some stage are going to have to dig them up if I find the time and split them up a bit.
Do you ever cut them to bring into the house?
Yes. these ones. Occasionally, after a show, I'd bring back big bunches which go into the house, yeah, or up to the local nursing home.
Well, we're kind of overwhelmed with daffodils today, I have to say. There's a daffodil for every situation, and the colour palette is just entrancing. It really is, from white, lily white, paper whites, to very vibrant oranges and golden yellows.
Yes, it's marvellous, and also the scent and the shape of them. There's such a variance in the scent, ranging from the really pungent, strong Tazettas through the more delicate Jonquilla onto the Poeticus, with the pheasant's eyes, very late in the season. You get a big bank of those pheasant's eyes and the lovely scent wafting up from them.
It must be all-consuming, though, this, you know, the passion for creating new daffodils and seeing what you might be able to create.
It's known as yellow fever, and it's addictive, it certainly is.
And how did it begin with you?
A wonderful old chap, Frank Harrison. I was at a dinner party with him, and he started talking about daffodils and what he was doing. And at university, I had an interest in genetics, and I just became hooked on the genetical side of it, really. And the genetics are very interesting in them, and having a slight knowledge helps. So really, that's how I got involved, and it was a hobby that got out of control and has become a business.
And is there anything that you're particularly excited about working on at the moment? Is there something that you're waiting to see come through?
A pink tete-a-tete, and then I'll retire.
Neil, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
And now to this week's diary, and later today, City of Derry and District Horticultural Society will have their annual spring show. That's in St Peter's Church Hall, Colmore Road in Londonderry. The times are from 2 until 4. Hillsborough Horticultural Society have their spring show today too. The venue, the village centre, and the time is 2 o'clock as well. With Mother's Day tomorrow, there are of course lots of things to do at the National Trust's properties in Northern Ireland, including guided spring strolls around the Victorian sunken garden and domain at Castle Ward, and the walks there take place at 11 o'clock and at 3, and that's tomorrow. On Tuesday the 5th, Cumberland District Horticultural Society have their AGM and their members' mini show, and that's at 7:45 in Cumber Primary School. And finally, on Thursday evening at 7:30, the Northern Ireland Organic Gardening Society will hold a public meeting and lecture in Antrim Civic Centre. Cherry Townsend will be guest speaker, and her topic, An Organic Future for Cut Flowers in Northern Ireland. And that's all from us for this week. If you'd like to download the programme as a podcast, just go to the Radio Ulster homepage and follow the links. Coming up next, On Your Behalf with Linda McCauley. But for now, from me, Cherry McIlwain, on behalf of producer Julie Brown and the rest of the team, thanks as ever for your company and enjoy your garden.